Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, episode 139. Man, we're starting to build up quite the library of episodes. I almost should go back and listen to some of the early ones and see how we did. Turning to be springtime. I'm in the Northeast today, 80 degrees. A little bit reminiscent, you know, the Boston Marathon's on this Monday coming up. Done it a few times, Don. And it was one time it was 89 and one time it was 36 degrees. And it's got such a range. And everyone's like, oh, how could it ever be 89 degrees in April? But, you know, I think we came probably close today. It's a Friday we're recording. So you never know what April will bring, which is a good sort of segue. Like, well, a bunch of our friends are running on Monday. I think Pete's running, right? Michael is running.
That's correct, yeah.
We probably have other friends. They're going to be out there going faster than I ever did. Fun course. Got to get you up there one time. It's this deceptively fun because the first 13 miles you can cook and then you then get cooked. Anyway, bringing it back to the focus of today, we're a few days away, well, maybe more than a few days away from heading to Arizona. Don's going to go try and run 250 miles at some blazing pace. And now it's, I think, the hardest time for all of us. You know, one of the things I always think about with this sort of idea of prep, training, tapering, racing, recovery is that we've learned so much about each of those over the past 25 years, for argument's sake, you know, from everyone runs hard to, oh my gosh, maybe I shouldn't, the tapering matters. There's a physical part to it. There's a psychological part to it. You're entering your taper now for the Cocodona 250. So let's talk about taper, the concept. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? Maybe we'll all learn a little bit about that. And then how, you know, probably too many questions, but how do you manage the energy system that's not being used at the same level right now? Because it's probably going to be like boiling over soon. So anyway, Don, how are you feeling? How's the taper going?
Joe, it's good. I guess I have, you know, this weekend is going to be my last, what I would call decent weekend. And then it's, you know, 2 weeks out from the race. So I'm still putting in a little bit of effort this week. And then next week we taper down. But you know what? Overall, the body feels really good. I'm really happy with where I'm at in my training. But I am definitely ready to taper. Like, everybody that's trained for something for a long time and has done a big training block knows that feeling where just everything is kind of more exhausting than it really is to you. It's just just little things like, oh gosh, I don't even want to do that. Like, just the whole system is tired right now. And so going into the taper, is the point of the taper, first and foremost, is to re-energize all of the systems, to repair the things that might be have broken down a little bit, to let little minor little injuries heal, and then just have the strength, energy, and confidence going into race day, knowing that your body is prepared. So that's kind of this my loose focus for these next few weeks.
When I was, you know, really in racing form, everyone always told me that, you know, in the 2 weeks leading up to a race, you can't get any faster or stronger, right? You can only actually get weaker if you're not careful, right? And so tell us a little bit about, like, what that just seems like, wow, if I'm working more, aren't I getting stronger all the time or faster all the time?
Yeah, it comes down to something that I've said a few times, is that, like, I would rather be 10% undertrained than 2% overtrained. Mm-hmm. And that's just if you look at the research on training cycles in the body, is that, like, if I, especially for 250 miles, there's really nothing I can do 8 days out from the race that's going to dramatically improve my muscular performance. Now, there is a whole nother wing of training that is mental training, that this is where, to answer your question that you asked before, is like, how do you manage the energy and the nerve? Some people call it the taper crazies. I think this is the prime time to double down on the mental side of your training, because you can like dramatically improve your performance from a mental standpoint in these next 2 weeks, but not necessarily your physical output. So I transition from more of a physical approach to more of a mental approach and work on my why, my resiliency mentally, and my just thought process and visualization of what do I do if I get X, Y, and Z? What do I do if I struggle? And that mindset serves as training. So as normally I would do 2 hours of training a day, I'm only run an hour. What am I going to do with that other hour that I'm used to doing besides drive my wife crazy? Okay, well now I'm going to maybe meditate a little bit more. I'm going to focus on the race. I'm going to visualize. I'm going to watch 20 minutes of YouTube videos, and then I'm going to turn off the lights and I'm going to visualize those sections. So those are kind of my thought processes for as far as like maintaining training without training and ensuring that I'm physically resting. I'm allowing my body to recover and repair while improving the other element that I actually can in that same time frame.
Yeah, so that's good. That's very helpful. I think that another part of this, you know, so there's lots of people, maybe they only do one race a year. You know, they don't go and do big stuff a lot. And so in that instance, you know, there's this definition of what everyone would call, and remember, racing is all relative. You know, this is for most of us. We're just trying to do our best, not really compete on the podium per se. But these concepts still work. This idea of an A race that sometimes people will talk about is priority and how one should think about that versus anything else that you might do in gearing yourself up, right? Because you could go and do a race if it's a B or a C race without a taper because output doesn't matter as much, right?
Yeah, I've used most of my racing this week, and I call those train through races, right? Like it's a part of your training for the other race. So instead of recovering and going into that race intentionally rested and fully ready to go out and rage on the course, you're actually going in intentionally a little fatigued. You're going in as it was a normal training week. Maybe even a slight taper, like a 4 to 5 day taper where the few days before you're just going to lower your intensity. And that there's some research that shows like that can just help with the risk of injury in those races because you're going to be just a little extra recovered, but you don't need those full 2 weeks for a train through race or a B or C race. And I've used that strategy. I've raced, let's see, I had two races in January, a race at the beginning of end of February, beginning of March, and then two more races. So I've had, you know, 5 races this year and not a single one of them would I consider an A race yet. So I've always had a more of a 7 to 10 day taper for these races all year and only about a 5 to 6 day recovery period after. Whereas this race in Cocodona, I'm going to have a full 2 week taper with probably a full 2 weeks after. I think a lot of people forget about the time after for your A race should be equal to your taper. And so I'm going to have a full 2 weeks after to recover and repair as well.
Yeah. And for those of us listening who are not doing big, big races, these are just good underlying concepts, right? That we've evolved to understanding how energy systems work. You know, there's sometimes where you worked a big week and you're just tired at the end of the week. You know, the fatigue turns into exhaustion because there are some energy systems that we have that are, we'll call them anaerobic versus aerobic, right? And, you know, it's not a perfect metaphor here. So aerobic uses oxygen, which we continually replace. The anaerobic system comes from in the cellular system inside our body. It needs to regen also. But the way it does that is when we're resting, when we go to sleep, and these systems are refreshing themselves. They do it all the time. When we're stressed at work or in our lives, we're producing some, you know, chemicals like cortisol in our body that there's only so much, and that's good to keep us having be aware, but the reason we go to exhaustion is because we have to go replace it because we need it again and there isn't a way to get there. So the exhaustion is a byproduct of the strain and the stress. And so this period of time that you're going through is not that dissimilar to anything else we do in our lives, where we take some time to, you know, let the system recover and rebuild. Mm-hmm. So it's ready to be used again in the way that we want to use it.
Right. I use the terminology with a lot of my athletes that stress is stress, right? Like cortisol doesn't know the difference between going out and hammering a marathon or buying a new house or going through a divorce. Like, stress is stress. And you oftentimes hear people say something like, oh, I need a vacation for my vacation, because they've gone out, they've traveled, they've had a full itinerary. Now they come back and they realize that, like, I've been overloaded mentally and physically for a week, and now I have to go back to work, and there is no rest and recovery. So, the underlying principle there is stress, and like I think about that a lot during taper as well. It's like, okay, where in my life can I prepare to minimize stress those few weeks leading up to the race? So it's things like, don't leave your race planning to 2 days before the race. You're adding stress to your life. Don't try to book a hotel at the start line 2 days before your race. That is stressful. Think about these little things that you can do before your taper, even the first week of your taper, that will allow you to basically go somewhat catatonic on race week and just go through the motions. And I highly recommend, I mean, Joe, this is, you know, the opposite of your life, but I highly recommend take a day or two off before a race from work and from travel early, because, and again, this is not possible for everybody. It's not likely that it's going to happen for everybody. I'm lucky enough to have the ability to take a couple days off before Cocodona, travel 3 days before the race, and then just rest Saturday and Sunday before the race. So, because those things are stressful. Driving all day is stressful. Traveling all day is stressful. Having to go to the grocery store in a town I don't know is stressful to some degree, right? You go to your market, you know exactly where the produce is, exactly where the milk is. You go to a grocery store 12 hours away, it's a really minor stress. This is a first world problem, but you might not know the layout of the grocery store, and that adds an element of stress. So my key here is just minimizing those things by thinking through them earlier rather than, you know, leaving things to last minute if possible.
Yeah, well, I think that's always good advice, because what you're just saying is, you know, balance out all, there's the demands of life or racing. They don't all have to be done at the same time, right? We can sequence them properly, which then gives us this opportunity to then stay closer to this homeostasis, this place of balance, rather than adding everything. Imagine if, I don't know, just to make it silly, if you're getting ready for a race and you decide to do all your training in one day, you know, you ran.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't do that. That wouldn't make any sense. And so, yeah, it's a good way to think about, you know, everything that we have going on in our lives, and to the degree that we can simplify and understand, you know, which is part of the difficulty. Sometimes when we aren't feeling anything explicitly, we think nothing's happening. You know, it's that, well, do you feel anything when you're sleeping? No, but a lot's happening. You know, do you feel anything when you're running in your zone two? Well, it doesn't feel like work, but a lot is happening. And so you don't always have to feel a strain to have something happening.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think we live in this dopamine society today where, you know, you can click a button and 2 hours later a package shows up from Amazon, and it's like that's something happening, and we know that and we get excited by that. So a lot of times you take all of that away and you just wake up and stare at a sunrise, and it's like, okay, is something happening? And it is. It absolutely is. And I would argue that more is happening sitting and by yourself and quiet and watching a sunrise. More is happening positive than clicking a button and having probably a package you don't need show up in 2 hours. But that's a different conversation to be had.
Well, I think that, you know, we build this system to operate in the environment that we're going to perform. And the more we learn about how it works, the higher the probability of success with that. So if we understand, you know, what nutrition does for us, what rest does for us, what exercise, what community, what learning, all of these, you know, and every once in a while you'll get that aha that says, oh, wow, all what I did paid off in this moment because I had put in all the work leading up to it. This idea that, you know, you may never need that skill, but boy, is it good to have it when you need it.
Right. Yeah. There's so many of those skills and thought processes. One of the elements I want to shift back a little bit, since you brought up sleep and said, you know, you don't think a lot of things are happening, but a lot of things are happening during sleep, because I always talk about sleep so much during my taper, because for me, that is one of the biggest indicators of like my readiness to go out and compete, is my ability in those 2 weeks prior to add more sleep. And I most days when I'm training hard, I focus on 7 hours of sleep. While I'm in my taper, I will focus on 8+ hours of sleep, and I do my best to get 9. And so this also helps. One, it helps, you know, minimizing time during the day where I'm going crazy because I'm adding that extra time back to my sleep. But it also just helps with those waking up feeling refreshed. You're repairing your body. I track my sleep metrics every day. It's the one metric I look at every single day. I don't even look at my heart rate. Lots of times I hit my watch start, I hit stop, and I never look at my run. I do look at my sleep every single day. So that is my metric, knowing that, am I recovered? Am I feeling good? Mm-hmm. I can focus on things that might help me get more deep sleep. Now, deep sleep is the reparative sleep. So that's where your body is repairing. I think everybody is familiar with REM sleep. REM sleep is where, you know, kind of in a remedial way, your brain is repairing, and your mental functions are repairing. But deep sleep is where your body is repairing. So I start tracking and looking a lot more intensely at things that I can do to improve my deep sleep during taper, which then I know will help repair my body, so that if I wake up and I go run 250 miles, I'm giving my body the best physical chance to go out and do successful at that. Joe, I know you live a little bit of a hectic lifestyle, and sleep is kind of a premium for you. How do you manage sleep with your schedule? Do you notice, like, if you don't get enough sleep before a race, does it impact your performance?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that we're all sort of, there's a probably, we'll call it sort of like, you know, relative measures on that, you know, so someone might do great with 9 or 10 hours, someone 6 or 7, you know, and so I think you get to know yourself. What I can tell for sure is when I sleep more than my average, I actually feel more rested. There's a point for me that I get somewhat of a diminishing return, or then I feel lethargic. And I think that this is one of the things that we really don't really fully understand, is when we should be waking up.
Yeah,
there's a good time to wake up sometimes, and but it's not easy to know that when, you know, we're scheduling time. But yeah, I definitely feel it, and I've worked, you know, none of us are getting any younger, so I've worked, as I'm going on in my ages here, to sleep more on a relative basis. I think when, you know, you push the envelope a little bit hard, you know, it can work, but it's risky. And I think that this idea of more sleep leading up to this, you do want to hit whatever it is, the stage or the start line, with the systems as topped off as they can be. So we ate enough, you know, the night before or the days leading up, we rested well, we didn't use these energy systems at the level that they might have been used when we were training. You know, we probably even want to be living in a much more positive world, you know, like stay away from negativity, and all of that makes a difference. You know, sometimes when you go out there, you're like, wow, I wonder why today was so good. It's all of that together, right? It adds up. But it does make a difference for sure. And so, yeah, I have come around to, you know, well, we're not Navy SEALs here, Don, and we don't need to be like sleeping on the sand waiting for the pontoon boat for an hour, you know?
Right. Yeah. And so it's interesting you mentioned it's hard to know, you know, when you should wake up. One of the things that Oura Ring, and so full disclosure, I work for Oura Ring. If anybody listening didn't know that, this is not me a sponsored ad. This is the company I work for. We've recently introduced the sleep chronotype, which actually, based on sleeping patterns in their app, it'll tell them what times you should sleep up. And so I was just looking at mine, and mine is an early morning type, which recommends my sleep time should be asleep by 8:33 p.m. And then based on my natural circadian rhythms, I should be asleep every day at 8:33 a.m. and I should be awake every day at 4:33 a.m. Wow. And so the big thing that this sleep chronotype can do is actually it really tries to just pinpoint the midpoint of your sleep. So if you're only going to get 5 hours, your midpoint should be, you know, still in that kind of that midpoint. Yeah. And so that's been really interesting. This is a new feature that I've started enjoying, and it's like, I never hit my midpoint because one, I don't usually go to fall asleep at 8:30, and I try my best not to wake up at 4:30 if I don't have to. But that's a really interesting thing because it's helping people understand that, hey, like, you might be forcing yourself to go to bed at 10 o'clock and waking up at 6, but actually for your best health, the data that's coming in says you should actually, like, you might be a super late night and you should be in bed at midnight and wake up at 8, or back that up even further. So yeah, it's just very interesting to see people being armed with this information and not being forced to be Dr. Matthew Walker, he wrote the book Why We Sleep, a lark or a night owl are the two different, you know, sleep profiles. And a lark obviously is an early morning type, and a night owl is a late night type. So it's just really interesting that there is the data out there that is now telling people what these are. So you go explore it if you're interested in that. There's more and more research to tell you wake up at this time.
Yeah, that's good. We should all just sort of keep learning. You know, maybe, I don't know, someone wants to take, you know, apple cider vinegar to help their balance their GI. You know, there's lots of things we could explore. Sleep is one of them. We eat differently. So just fun to dig in on some of these, and the more research that goes on, the better. And then experiment with ourselves, right? See how we do.
Yeah. Yep. N-of-1 data is huge, right? Don't sit around and wait for somebody to tell you what you should do. Get as many data sources on yourself as possible and start making some decisions. You know, don't go out and change every element of your life and expect to understand the results like any other science experiment. Change one variable and try to figure it out. I could tell you I've changed my diet completely based on sleep and blood draw data. And so I started learning that the nights I was sleeping best were the nights that I wasn't eating meat before. And so I became vegetarian, and now I'm a year and a half in, and the data still says it's the right choice. And I backed it up with regular blood draws. And I've given up alcohol because the data says that. I've changed how I train based on my heart rate data. So it's just, it's very interesting. And we're kind of getting tangential to where we started this topic, but it's a cool topic to think about. We've never had access to more individualized data than we do right now, right? We don't have to wait for a lab to tell us how we're sleeping. We don't have to wait for a lab to tell us what our heart rate was out on a run, or what even your pulse ox at any moment of the day. So it's how people are using that data to optimize their life. And for me, it's never more relevant than it is during a taper, to kind of seal this back to where we started. Individualized data, N-of-1 data. I started doing N-of-1 data on things like ice baths and sauna usage to understand, you know, what happens if I do this 20 days in a row, does it make a difference? And it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And isolating that data. I think that, you know, I work on this a bit, but this broader, more frequent access to data at a broad scale health level. I've been on this bandwagon lately, which is, it seems about the dopiest thing we could ever do is take our blood pressure once a year. What would that tell you? Like on that one day, that would indicate something?
It's a moment in time. That's all it is. You're capturing one moment.
And for a piece of data that actually matters, maybe we should be doing that every day. Like, why would you think that, you know, like, should wait till next year before I do it again? So I do think that this data can have an effect in a very positive way on a lot of people who are not even trying to taper for a race, but just trying to live the best version of themselves.
Absolutely. And especially to use your example of blood pressure data, there's so many things that go into just making, even if you have a full bladder, you're going to have higher blood pressure. So like if you go into the doctor's office and you have to pee and don't, you're going to have high blood pressure versus if you just went to the bathroom first. It's just the fact that it can vary by that small of a change. And there's a ton of other things, whether you ate or not, what time of the day, obviously. But that's always one that makes me laugh is like, just go to the bathroom before you get your blood pressure and it might be lower. The fact that that is true means you should take it more often. If there's that little variability, that small thing can make that change, take it often.
Yeah, I think in that instance, it's like the relative is better than the absolute. You know, over the past 20 days, look, it's really different from something. You know, that's what really matters. Then you know something's happening versus, it was high today, it was low today. Like, so what? That's not as indicative.
Right. And this is why I personally get blood draws every quarter. Just so it's not because I think I'm unhealthy. It's more that I have a really strong track record of data that if something does become like this all of a sudden spiked, like, I can say that that's not normal for me. Whereas somebody that maybe gets their blood drawn once every 3 years, maybe that's normal for you over these last 3 years. And there's a bigger story to tell versus like this one spike. Now I can have quickly actionable data that I can say, hey, that's not normal. Let's look into why that happened over the last 3 months versus maybe it's been a 3-year thing. And I don't know. There's so many dangerous things that we can do not knowing about our health.
Yeah. More we dig in. This is the same kind of idea with this taper. Maybe one more question. Have you been thinking much about the sleep pattern you're going to have during the race?
That is probably the single most popular question that I've gotten in the past month and a half is around sleep. And so I went out to Vegas back a month and a half ago, and I did that 48-hour race with the sole purpose of feeling that second night in a race, understanding where I get tired, where I don't. So I do have a somewhat loose strategy. The challenge is the research shows the best time to sleep on a multi-day race is right before the sun rises. That's kind of what the research shows. However, this is a hot race. And so my strategy is to, you know, get as many miles at night when the sun is down and then survive the day. So I have some conflicting thoughts on, you know, do I follow the research, sleep before the sun is up and sacrifice some cool miles, or do I sacrifice if I can get to an aid station at 2 p.m. when it's, you know, 115 degrees and get into an air conditioned camper and then sleep a couple hours there. So that second option is where my mind is at, is sleep when I'm going to be least comfortable out on the trail and survive the nights by, you know, just if I'm tired, take a little dirt nap here and there. But don't take more dedicated sleep during the night, just so I can take as much advantage as possible as the cooler temperatures. I don't think I'm going to get myself into trouble by running. You know, running hard is relative. It's 250 miles. So when I say running hard, it's not like I'm, you know, dropping 6-minute miles, but pushing a little bit higher effort levels overnight versus I'm more willing to be off the trail when it's 100 degrees and then get back on the trail when maybe it's dropped into the 90s or the 80s.
Good strategy. We'll see how it works.
And with anything, I mean, Joe, you've done, this is the great unknown for me. You've done a 200 miler before. I think the most important plan that I have is to be agile, right? To be willing to just say, you know what, that seemed like a good idea at the time. And it's not going to be a successful plan right now. There's so many things that can change and will change over 3 days that I can't plan for right now. Yeah. And if you're unwilling to, you know, deviate from a plan that I set on paper 1,000 miles away, then I don't think I'm going to be successful in this race. So I have to be willing to be like, yep, I wanted to run through the night, but I am miserable and I'm tired and I'm tripping. I'm going to lay down. Like, I just have to be willing to do that.
I think smart. Smart is good in that setting, yeah, as we know. Well, you know, a couple weeks to go here. We're turning on spring across the country, so that's sort of fun for all of us. You know, everyone should get out this weekend and take a walk or just appreciate the birds chirping and the leaves starting to come out. I know in the mountains there's probably still some snow, but for the rest it's probably pretty good.
It was 70 here yesterday and it was snowing most of the day today. But at the same time, I just put all of our hummingbird feeders out yesterday because this is about the time of the year that the mountain hummingbirds come out in force. And it's a really, really amazing spectacle that I'm looking forward to, hopefully happening before we get out to Arizona.
All I want to say, Don, is that whether it was poison ivy or poison oak that I got 2 weeks ago in Portland is still with me in a very big way.
I'm sitting here itching my knee right as you say that. We both... Jonah, yeah, both got, I think we mentioned that when we talked about our DNF reports, but
it doesn't want to go away.
It's, yeah, like
forever here. I am definitely, well, I'm glad
it's lingering
along with me here. Oh my gosh. Well, we'll all be rooting for the taper to work next week. We'll have an interesting guest on. We appreciate you guys hanging out with us. Have fun. Let's chase tomorrow together. We'll talk to you soon.